Welcome to season two of A Conflict of Interest. As you know from season one, this podcast originated out of a capstone project from my master's program in negotiation and conflict resolution through Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. With this podcast, we are striving to create a digital learning community and to raise conflict awareness and improve workplace culture by challenging our mindsets. Over the course of six episodes for season one, we opened conversations on self-awareness, emotional intelligence, trust and team building, and culture and communication. If this is your first episode and you enjoy it, I would be so thankful if you spent time listening to some of the episodes from the first season. As always, I welcome any feedback and thoughts on these episodes, and I encourage you to write me at michael.giacopelli@lewisbrisbois.com. We had such an amazing response to our episode with Professor Kelly Gehring from Creighton that I thought it would be a great way to start the second season if I was able to have a conversation with another professor. I am thrilled to introduce Dr. Erica Kirby to this podcast, where we will discuss nonverbal communication, organizational communication, and work-life balance. We'll discuss body language, interpreting nonverbals, and explore a head-to-toe guide. I hope you enjoy. Dr. Erica Kirby is Professor of Communication Studies and the A.F. Jacobson Chair in Communication. She has been at Creighton for over 20 years. She received her PhD from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln in organizational communication, and she studies the everyday intersections of working and personal life, emphasizing how differing social identities, especially gender, assimilate into and collide with organizational structures. She teaches organizational communication courses and courses related to communication and social justice. In 2016, she was awarded the Wolbert Award by the National Communication Association. At Creighton, she has been a department chair in communication studies and modern languages and literatures. She is past president of the Organization for the Study of Communication, Language, and Gender. Dr. Kirby, welcome to A Conflict of Interest.
Thank you so much.
Is there anything else about your background that you'd like to mention?
The one thing I did forget to say is that we just had a second edition of our book on gender come out this year. So I've written a little bit more about that recently.
Oh, wonderful. So you and I met about 2 years ago when you gave a presentation during the master's residency. And since then, I just wanted to continue the conversation that we had. And I'm really also so very impressed that you agreed without hesitation to do a podcast on nonverbal communication.
Right. Meaning
where we're just supposed to talk to each other. So I guess let's get started with 30 minutes of awkward silence.
Silence is nonverbal communication.
So in its most basic form, what is nonverbal communication?
At the most basic form, nonverbal communication is communication without words. And so it's all the intentional and unintentional messages that we send other than the use of language. So there's a lot of things that can go into that. Our facial expressions, touching, our tone of voice, our dress, our posture, gestures, the way we sit, how fast, how loud we talk. Lots of things can be nonverbal. And I was sort of joking, but nonverbal communication doesn't even always have to be anything that we're intending to do. Silence and the way that we like act in silence can be nonverbal communication as well.
So I was listening to a TED talk, I think it was Leila Tacconi's, and she had introduced nonverbal communication as one of the most amazing, beautiful languages of all time. Why is it so important? Why is this language, this form of communication, so important?
Well, I think it's important partially because if we think about, I think her point probably in one of the most beautiful languages of all time is that we have been communicating nonverbally as human beings longer than we've been creating or communicating through words. And when you think about that, all the different actual languages that we have, not even just in the United States, but worldwide, we still are able to have, when we nonverbally communicate, some shared things. You know, there's ideas that there are facial expressions that are just universal and almost natural. And so to be able to start to interpret some of those things, we've had nonverbal communication a lot longer than we've had the verbal So to be able to pay attention to it is something that's really important, but it's something that a lot of people don't think about. And I would actually like further our conversation about how you introduced how we met through your residency, that I was just a little bit surprised that, you know, when you're talking about throughout a whole program, the importance of words, I'm sure, was out there in terms of negotiation and conflict resolution. But, you know, if there's ever any disconnection between what's being said verbally and the nonverbals, for better or for worse, people are usually going to believe what's happening nonverbally rather than what's being said. So I just think it's so important. Not only in terms of historically, but it's just in terms of usefulness to really consider our nonverbals.
Why do you say that's the case, that they'll believe what's being performed nonverbally?
So they have what's, like in nonverbal research, we have what's called Moravian's formula. And it really just looks at, it looks at incongruence. Like when there's intentional incongruence between what's being said and the nonverbals. So maybe, you know, I say that I'm really happy, but my nonverbals show that I'm not, or some sort of like, we know that they don't match up. Like what has been shown in laboratory sort of studies is that we'll believe 55% based on body language that has nothing even to do with what's coming out of anyone's mouth, 38% with the tone of voice, and then 7% of the actual words spoken. And I would put the caveat there that sometimes that formula is treated as universal, but I would just want to emphasize that it was created like for that specific context of incongruity being there. But there are probably a lot of times in situations for negotiators, mediators, attorneys where that incongruence is there. And so it's really important to understand juries or whatever are often going to go to the nonverbal first.
Why don't you think it's taught? You know, if nonverbals are is such an important part of it, it's 55% is on body language. Why don't you think it's part of, you know, what we're experiencing?
I don't know. I mean, it was really interesting to me that it wasn't when I was interacting with some teachers from the program. They're like, oh, that would be important to talk about. And, you know, I think it's a Western culture thing that we emphasize so much, the cognitive and the rational, that we don't always think about other things that are leading into how people are creating meaning. In terms of, you know, the visual, if you pick up like, so in communication studies, if you pick up a rhetoric textbook, so much about arguments is like, here's what to say. And then maybe they'll have a very little chapter at the end about, oh, and here's some visual components. So I think a lot of times just the way that we are, I don't know, socialized into learning doesn't emphasize this, even though it's certainly as important as what we're saying. And maybe it's because, you know, a lot of times with communication, people think, oh, I know how to do that. I've been doing that my whole life. And so we don't think of it as a worthy thing of study. But, you know, if it really does have that much impact, I think we need to give it more weight than we currently do.
And I know this might be a little out of your wheelhouse, but as you know, I'm an attorney and I work for a law firm. And one of the things that you mentioned in passing just now was how it plays in the courtroom. You know, how do you think body language does play in a courtroom with juries, with your adversaries, with the judge?
Yeah, well, I actually, because I knew who my audience was going to be, I did a little bit of just looking at like what has been published in terms of nonverbals in a courtroom. And I was actually kind of shocked at how little there was. So there was like a 1984 study, then a 1993 study, and then a 2017 study that kept coming up and not that much in between. But there, I think there were some takeaways that are worth talking about, because sort of across all of them, they said that the nonverbal communication, like of the courtroom participants in general, ways that it could influence outcomes. One is by the nonverbals that can alter judgments of credibility, which I'm sure people would think of right away, you know, in terms of deception and what we're perceiving in terms of witnesses as well as, you know, defendants, that it can secondly facilitate self-disclosure. So the ways, you know, that an attorney is interacting with a witness, there are ways that nonverbals can be used to, you know, look more likable or something like that to get more disclosure. that nonverbals can be used to foster attitudes of like or dislike in the courtroom. Another one was to sort of spread emotion. So when you think about like nonverbals, a lot of times how nonverbals communicate is they are how we communicate emotions versus the rational part. And so, but at least these authors were saying that extends into a courtroom. There was one quote that I thought was really great because it kind of like brought all the parts together. And it was from this 1984 study, which sounds really old, but nonverbal communication, you know, we've been doing it forever as human beings. So it probably still stands. And so Levan said, in the courtroom, nonverbal communication subtly affects the entire proceedings of a trial. It is constantly present and being asserted, yet the attorney is often unaware of its existence. Gestures and facial expressions are transmitted and observed by every individual in the courtroom. The attorney, in her opening statement, uses gestures and eye contact to persuade the jury. The judge silently communicates her feelings about the case to the jury through her posture and facial expressions. The client unwittingly sends messages to the jury through his general appearance and the clothing he wears. A witness on the stand under the scrutiny of the jury reveals more through fidgeting with his clothes and shifting his body than he does through his testimony. So I just thought that was like a really good encapsulating like quote of like all the ways it might start to come into play. And then I also, one article in particular, the 2017 one, wanted to undo misconceptions about what deception looks like. Because it has never scientifically been proven that if you avert your gaze, you're lying. But a lot of people believe that, right? And then if judges believe that and see a witness doing that, or, you know, if the jury believes that, it's sort of furthering this message of like what deception looks like. And so what they wanted to do was talk about like, there's misconceptions, but like social scientifically, what could we know about deception? Would this be of interest if I just talked about those for a minute?
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. So they, I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about how you can never do any, you should never look at any one nonverbal communication pattern and say, that's this, which is why we can't say someone averts their eyes, they're lying. You want to look at things more in terms of clusters of behaviors. So like things about nonverbals that come in patterns together. And so they said, if you really want to think more about deception, that you should look for patterns of uncertainty and tension and cognitive load were the three things. And then they sort of said, and here's how you would see those clusters. So to think about deception, that people are showing uncertainty. If someone is trying to deceive, they tend to be less certain of their statements because they're maybe fabricating on the spot or altering the reality that they know to be true. And so in terms of clusters, you might see longer pauses because their brain's kind of having to catch up, shorter answers because they don't want to be too elaborate and have to remember what they said, more tentativeness and less nonverbal involvement are signs of uncertainty. So like there really maybe aren't as many nonverbal signals going on because they're trying to think in terms of the uncertainty is preventing that a little bit. Then it was really interesting because the tension part is sort of how people, most of us are socialized into thinking, okay, if people lie, it looks like this. And so the tension says that if I know I'm going to deceive, I'm going to try to control my behavior to avoid showing those cues that I think signal deception so that I appear credible. So like they try to control leakage of cues that are associated with deception. So if I assume that if I look away or if I fidget, that's going to show I'm lying, I'm going to try especially hard not to do those behaviors, which is going to make me maybe even look like more stiff and tense than I would have in the beginning. And so they would say the science shows that tension would result in fewer gestures because I'm trying not to move around too much, more vocal and facial tension. So like you can sort of see on my face that I don't seem very natural, like lips being pressed together. I don't think it says greater pupil dilation. I don't think in a normal courtroom situation anybody's going to be close enough to see that happening, but like more rigid body posture would show that tension as well. So I'm just like, I'm trying so hard not to leak out what I think people look for in a lie that I end up being more tense is a cluster that I said you could look for. And then the last one of cognitive load is, so I'm going to try to like not look, I'm trying to balance so much in my head about what we said before of the uncertainty, because I know I'm in the lie, and the tension. So I'm not going to gesture as much. And this, you can sort of tell in my demeanor. So it's sort of combines those two things in terms of tension and uncertainty, that this cognitive load is causing these pauses, causing me to seem more stiff. And so they would say that's a better way to look at deception, a more scientific way than we have before. So I thought that was just really interesting how little research had been done, and when it was, how it was mostly about how do you tell if people are lying.
If you think about how you view things, just even in your office, not even in the courtroom, but you're always looking at other people's body language.
Totally.
And in this instance where you're talking about deception, that the person is thinking about how can I use my body language to convey something. And I feel like people aren't always thinking about how their own body language is coming off, but they're always viewing the other person's body language.
Absolutely. I think that's a very interesting thing about nonverbals, right? And even when we're taking in other people's, it might not be at the conscious level, right? But it still is helping us make meaning. But it's not that often that we think of our own. And so like, you know, when I was thinking about the courtroom situation and it talks about like ways that you present yourself and things, I was even thinking about like myself, and no one can see me except you right now because we're on a podcast, but I have pink hair and a nose piercing. And I was thinking like, okay, I have a PhD, but would I still take out my nose piercing and do something different with my hair to be in a courtroom just to be perceived as more credible, right? So I do think that when you pay attention to these things, there's a lot about yourself that you might scrutinize in different ways when you're paying attention to your own nonverbals.
Can you train yourself for your own nonverbals?
There is research that especially talks about you can talk yourself into feeling powerful by doing certain nonverbals. And so there's been some studies by Dr. Amy Cuddy and others that looks at especially the gendered nature of nonverbals and how sometimes men are more comfortable taking open and big positions and women take up sort of less space. And so the studies were to look at, okay, if you want to like instill confidence in yourself, are there nonverbal things you can do that will like train yourself? And so they did what they called the Wonder Woman position, where you stay with your legs sort of spread and, you know, put your hands on your hips for 2 minutes in this power position. And then they had them do, it was a controlled experiment, but they had them like interview with someone afterwards, and they saw it, an increase in their confidence. And so there's research that starts to show that if there are certain nonverbal things you want to convey and you practice them and you enact them, that you can have some changes. I think it's really important though to think about like authenticity in that, because if you're trying to make yourself a person that you're not, I don't think that that's going to be read as credible or authentic. So it's one thing to try to like build your confidence a little bit going into somewhere, but then, you know, if you went into that same interview and you actually held the Wonder Woman position, people would not know what to do with that, right? But so it's this idea of, can there in certain places be ways that you train your brain to like, it's the almost some using the body language as a mind over matter thing in terms of confidence.
Amy Cuddy, essentially saying your body language may shape who you are, right?
So yes.
She talks about the power poses and even Usain Bolt with his arms out in the victory stride. And you mentioned the Wonder Woman pose, but even Megan Rapinoe's, her pose.
Absolutely.
Is there a gender difference in these power poses, and how does power come into play with a power pose, across genders and across power?
It's interesting because when we look at like this idea of success in the victory pose, like when someone's won a race or something like that. They've even found that people that are born without eyesight will like strike this pose of throwing their arms up in the air, that almost seems natural. But then socialization comes into play. And so definitely women are socialized to take up less space, to cross their legs versus to spread them out. Men are socialized that it's okay to take up more space. And so I do think that there are definite gender differences that can be socialized. And then it's just how much can women push the bounds back before they aren't seen as being too masculine and read differently when they try to take on some of those poses that, you know, it might be more natural for a man to be doing. So I do think that, I also think that men could be read in a certain effeminized way too, if they have their posture that's more, I think that in our minds, we have like what looks like a male open posture, what looks like a female open posture. And when people violate those, we do notice.
In sports and in teams, body language, you know, reading the other players' movements, reading the other players' body language, high-fiving, dancing, making that connection, taking a knee, raising a fist, like all of those things in sports are so important. How does that world move itself into the work world? Like the, showing that... It's so important everywhere, but the workplace. Tell me why it's important in the workplace, why body language is important in the workplace.
Yeah, I think that when we're thinking about in the workplace, we often think about just like the, oh, I've got to give a public speech. And then we think about, you know, what we look like then. But our nonverbals are being read like on the regular basis. So I would think like individually, Time Magazine actually did. I thought it was interesting. They did this list of what are the most common body language mistakes at work. And I think like talking about that on the individual level, I think is just a little bit important because some of these things I know that I do and I wouldn't have even thought about it. So I'll talk about those. And then also like thinking about like the high-fiving of a team, what does like nonverbal look like in community? We should maybe talk about a little bit too. But these this list of seven like body language things that people do that are problematic. I know that I fit into some, so I'll go through them. The first one was bad posture or slouching. And so, you know, you're at your computer all day and maybe you start to melt into it more and someone walks by your office and looks at you and sort of they said, it might not be right at the top of someone's mind, but like in the back of their mind, slouching conveys that people might not be as competent as those who sit up straight.
Or even as energetic or caring, right?
Right, right. Yeah, so like just sort of like, and are you as attentive as you should be? And so, you know, they just talk about ways to think about that differently by like just moving back in your chair and straightening up just a little bit. Like you don't have to be stiff, but like just to be mindful of that. And then fidgeting and nervous cues. I am personally a kinesthetic learner. And so like if I'm at a meeting, I actually usually doodle and things like this. And it's not because I'm not listening. It's because I am listening that I have to doodle, if that made sense. Like I have to be doing something with my hands. And so then, you know, every once in a while I'm like, you know, I'm in my 40s and I'm doodling these little flowers. I'm like, this does not seem all that professional. What should I do differently? And so now I actually, I have like just a little stone that I rub between my fingers and I don't think people notice it that much, but it allows me to have that same sort of a thing in terms of I can't stop fidgeting completely because, you know, when we talked earlier about this, like what's authentic to you, like if I tried to stop completely, I think I'd be concentrating so much on like not fidgeting that I wouldn't be listening. And so it's sort of figuring that out. I mean, some people twirl their hair, some people play with things on the table. Some crack their knuckles. Oh, goodness sakes, that one gets me. But, and sometimes we do these things without even knowing them. So that was their second thing, like these fidgeting and nervous cues. A third one kind of maybe plays off of that, like slouching or like being at your computer and being really in the zone about how, like, if you have a look of deep concentration, like your eyes are a little narrow, your brow gets furrowed. For some people, they think that that like is frustration or anger, when really like you were just concentrating. And so their tip, which I thought was interesting, was to like, if someone, like you're at your computer and someone's coming into your office, as you look up, imagining that like as they're crossing your threshold, you're crossing a threshold to them, and like look up with this consciously relaxed face and things. And I know that I could take that one in, because like sometimes I'll just look straight up and I probably do look, you know, really intense. And I never thought anybody would read that in a certain way, but it makes sense that they might. Their fourth one was just about being too casual. And especially in an era where like it's getting more and more common to like business casual and dress down, like is there still some line to be had there? And so Time Magazine said, despite the increase in casual workplace atmospheres, we've forgotten that our brain still reads people in very much the same way. That like we've trained ourselves to read a suit differently than jeans, no matter how much we say workplace norms have changed. And so to sort of be aware of that. Looking down or not making eye contact, so someone does come in your office and you don't look up angrily, but you just keep typing for just, you know, a few minutes while they're coming in. What does that signal? Like, I don't want to engage with you. I'm too busy to engage with you. Or if I'm looking down at my phone in a meeting, and that's pretty common nowadays. And I feel like at least in my workplace, people bring their laptops to meetings and are, some of the times it doesn't seem like they're that engaged at all. So how do we make sure we're making eye contact and show who's running the meeting or in the meeting with me that we're in it with them? Crossing your arms, I don't think that's a new one to anyone, that can be read as closed body language. And then their seventh thing was close talkers and people who stand too close to people. So I thought that was an interesting list of like body language mistakes that people might not think about. But what you said also about like team building and things like this, what does that look like? And I mean, some offices would do something like a high five, right? But probably not that often. It probably more is in terms of like environmental things. How are we creating openness, you know, in our environments? It could also be, you know, like I was just talking about before, like in a meeting, does everybody have their, you know, laptops out and they're down and looking, or are they looking up at each other and engaging and conversing? And like, how are people thinking about communication climates when we have these devices with us all the time? Because I don't go to too many meetings anymore where people just bring a piece of paper and a pen.
That's actually a good place to go, because I want to know how technology is impacting our interpretation. We're losing body language in the current generation, right? How can you read body language if the primary way that you're interacting is through text and email? So is the coming generations going to lack the ability to interact, to read body language socially? What are the repercussions? Are we losing body language?
That's super interesting. I think that, because in my head, I always frame it as, are we losing the ability to have the face-to-face conversation? But maybe it is the body language part of it, right? That I'm wondering about the slippage in, because, so I have daughters that are 22 and 20, and they are certainly conversing with people a lot all day long, but it is on social media platforms. It's not putting the phone to their ear as often. And so they don't get, even, you know, that statistic I gave to you before said that, you know, when there's incongruence, 38% of what we rely on is vocal tone, even if we couldn't see anything else. And we don't even have that, right? So it's just the words. But I also do wonder if emojis are their own form of body language now. So like on my newest version of the iPhone, like there's a person that looks just like me, you know, giving a thumbs up and doing all these things. And so it's this bizarre thing that rather than just showing our own body language to others, we've created emojis of ourselves to do the body language, because we're not doing enough face-to-face.
That's exactly right.
It's very strange. I love the Bitmoji and everything, but it is like we're doing this animated version of ourselves to show body language.
Right, and it's an animated version of ourselves, but just close enough, because it's not going to be the right. It's not going to be authentic. It's not going to be genuine. It's going to be a thumbs up where you want a thumbs up and maybe a shoulder shrug, you know, something like that. So
right. And it can never be a cluster. It can only be a one thing, right? Which we say, you know, that doesn't train people to really read nonverbals, to do it in these sort of like little one thing ways.
While you were going through the time list, I was thinking, you know, when we had the residency, you were giving us a head to toe guide.
Yes.
Would you share
that? Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just in terms of people thinking about their own nonverbals, there's lots of things to think about, and to go in any more detail, you know, too much detail is probably, we don't have enough time for, but even just to think about, like, literally head to toe. I said before that, like, having pink hair communicates something. So we started the head with the hair. Eyebrows, I think, communicate so much. And that was part of the time thing too. Like, are they furrowed? Are they raised? And then eyes and eye contact, clearly we give a lot of credence to that. Eye contact, especially, is there too much? Is there too little? Eye rolling. We talked about how generationally, you know, maybe things have changed. The young people still roll their eyes. And what does that mean? And I do think, like, there's a whole new facet of eye contact with, can you maintain eye contact for a long time without glancing at your phone? So those are things to think about with eye contact. Facial expressions. I think I said earlier that, you know, we've had this read of, there's a science, it's scientifically proven that there are certain facial expressions for each of the seven basic human emotions: for anger, contempt, disgust, fear, happiness, sadness, and surprise. Like, when people show that, we can find that right away. And so what facial expressions are being shown, including smiling. Smiling gets a lot of debate in terms of, should you smile more? Should you smile less? And like, a lot of the science has come down to, like, just smile at the right times. Like, you don't have to smile all the time, especially in a position of power. It would look strange. But like, if an occasion calls to smile, you should smile. Your chin and your neck. So how do you hold your head? And nodding. Experts advise, like, to show engagement, to do a triple nod, three quick small nods in a row to say, like, tell me more, I hear you, explain, to show engagement. Vocalics. So this is like, you know, in a podcast, this is the one form of body language that's going to be there is tone of voice. So what's the voice tone, the pace, pausing, volume, inflection, pitch, articulation. I just came off of a semester where I had 75 students where I had to grade their videos on a regular basis. And, you know, the vocal tone of someone who just gives a speech totally monotonously for like 5 minutes straight, it's real hard to pay attention, right? Versus someone that can keep your engagement with that inflection. And also, people really, when we speak, they read our voices in addition to listening to our words, including vocal fillers like ums and uhs. Like, I do that in my natural speech as well and try to eliminate it in public presentations, but it really is something that people think about. So if we go then in our downward, in our head to toe guide, posture is the next thing to think about. We just talked about that with the time body language issues. Just, is it straight, sagging, leaning forward or back? If you want to know sort of like what the guideline is, a female leg stance in North America is with the feet typically 4 to 6 inches apart, and a male power stance is more than 8 inches apart. So, like, how do we think about that? And really, they said that the best way to think about your posture, if there was a string like gently pulling you up, so you're not too rigid, but just sitting up straight. We know that arms communicate something in terms of like crossing those looks like protectiveness or like obstructiveness. Hands and gestures get a lot of attention in terms of nonverbals. You can't see this because we're on a podcast, but I talk with my hands a lot. And I think my students probably get a big old kick out of it, because like, I really, sometimes when I think, my hands need to be moving with it. I told you, when I'm at a meeting, I need to be doing something. But for some people, that can be really distracting. So I will actually, like, sometimes if I'm doing an all-day training, just start with saying, I'm going to try to be mindful of this, but I know I talk with my hands. That might be happening. That sort of a thing. And then just the nervous gestures and fidgeting. They say the best thing in that situation is just to put them in your lap is the most neutral way to do it. We know that there's certain ways that you can try to look more confident, you know, through the ways you put your hands. The box of putting them like side by side, Bill Clinton would put them, his advisors, like he used to have really big gestures and they said, think about your body as a box and your hands have to stay inside of that. Holding like, almost like you're holding a ball is a sign of confidence. If you want to look just self-assured, you put your hands in a pyramid and put them on the table so you're not doing anything with them. If your palms are up, it looks like you're honest and accepting. If your palms are down, it's a way to show strength. So there's a lot of things that we do with our hands and touch.
And if your hands are behind your back, you know, people that don't trust you, you know, they want to know what's going
Absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. They want to see those hands. And then like the way that you put them shows sort of different things. Legs, I think, I love the meetings where we sit behind places that have skirts on the table so I don't have to worry about it because I know legs communicate things. But if you really tightly cross them, it's sort of a more closed position. But, you know, if they're just all splayed out in front of you, that seems careless as well. And then in terms of how we stand, how strong that looks communicates something. And then, of course, beyond like, so the head-to-toe guide, that's sort of everything, except for maybe tapping our feet. The people that like tap their feet a lot, that can be distracting too. But then we think about the things that we put on our bodies, into tattoos or piercings, clothing, especially in the workplace and accessories, how that gets looked at in terms of credibility. And then space is probably the last thing, like how much interpersonal space do you have? And the guideline is like, you know, someone intimately, you can be within 18 inches. Personally is 18 inches to 4 feet. Like just a general social situation, 4 feet to 12 feet. And then public space is 12 feet and beyond. And then actually, it's hard to like categorize this, but they have this olfactics is looking at nonverbals as smells and craniemics as time. So like when I show up to something is a nonverbal message. As well. And then I do think with, there's been a lot of like allergy things where some workplaces are actually saying like, you can't wear fragrance anymore and things like that in terms of smells.
When I was thinking about this podcast, two women came to mind and the way that they had asked and interpreted nonverbals. And one was Hannah Gatsby when she did Nanette, she did a stand-up show. And I don't know if you've seen it, but she was her stand-up was so emotionally strong that afterwards she had said that she stood in the same place and she didn't move because the message was so powerful that she didn't want to distract people with her body language, with her movement.
So she intentionally stood in one place.
Intentionally stood. She was literally taking a stand because her message was so strong. And then on the flip side of that, I was thinking about Brené Brown, and Brené Brown had her Netflix special, and she had always said, I have them turn the house lights on because I want to read the crowd. I want to read their body language. I want to read how they're seeing me and see their body language. So based on, you know, Hannah Gatsby is, how can what I'm doing impact the way that people receive my message? And it's, you know, if I'm going to stand still, if I'm going to walk around with my hands. And then Brené Brown was, based upon what I'm doing, how are they receiving my message? And what can I do to change that if I need to?
Yeah. Tailor it as needed. Yeah. Yeah.
How do you, when we were doing the residency, you gave the three C's of interpreting nonverbals, and we spoke briefly about one of them.
Clusters, so I think, yeah. Clusters.
So I was hoping that you could hit the other two.
Totally. As
finish up.
Yeah. So those three C's are to think about the context, like the environment that the situation is taking place in. And so how is the environment of doing stand-up versus in a courtroom versus an organization like different how in terms of how we're going to read it. The history between the people and other factors. So like the roles of the people, if one person has more power than the other, is all going to play into this. And the fact that every conversation is about feelings as well as identity. And so that all that feeds into nonverbals there. And then clusters I talked about a little bit before, but it's just this idea to not read too much into a single cue. And so like to look at openness by multiple things that people are doing or closedness, you know, openness, in terms of what are my hands doing? What are my legs doing? What does my face look like? And not just to read one thing. That head to toe guide, you know, like crossing your arms could be that you're resisted, but it could be just that I'm cold. So to try to look at things in combination. And then that idea of congruence that we've also talked about just a little bit, like, do these things go together? Does the spoken words match the tone and the body language? So if I'm thinking about the context and the clusters and the congruence, I know a lot more than if I just looked and said, they're looking away from me and so they're lying. So it's a way to have a lot more pieces to put together for that. And then within that, you know, there's sometimes suggestions of if you do want to use body language to a certain extent, like, can you mirror the cluster that someone else is using to build more trust and things like that?
This is such a great opportunity. So I'm so grateful for your time. And I know that there's an entire body of work that we haven't even gotten into. And I just wanted to ask one question, just so we can hit on it. You know, you do so much on nonverbals, you do so much on organizational communication, but you also do a lot of research and work on work-life balance. And as an attorney in a giant firm with a lot of stress and a lot of attorneys with a lot of stress, and what's your advice on that? What can you give us?
It's been interesting for me because part of my advice comes from looking back and wishing I'd done things a little bit differently. So I think some advice that I would give is think about where you are in life and how fast you want to run that race. Because like for me, you know, once I've jumped a certain amount of hurdles, there's not that much ahead of me. And I sometimes second guess what happened before. Mm-hmm. I know that each like place that people work is different, but like for the leave that you are allowed, take that leave. Mm-hmm. The United States leaves so many vacation days untouched. And so many men that could have parental leave don't take it because of masculinity norms and things like that. So I think that this idea of whenever there is a policy that could help to bring balance back into your life, to do that. I also think that there's something to be said for figuring out your own circadian rhythms of when you get things done. And, you know, so if it is that you're most productive early in the morning and you want to be able to get your kids, ask your boss if you can do this, you know, something like coming in earlier to be able to leave early. If you want to sleep in because you know you're more productive at 6 o'clock, you know, like, is there a way to? I feel like a lot of places are willing to have a core time where they want most people there, but then will sometimes on the front end or the other end let people kind of work to what they best feel like. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
Isn't that an element to that is nonverbals? Like your physical presence being in an office could be, you know, quote, seen as hard.
Definitely.
And I work with somebody who really values FaceTime. Yes. And you have to be there as long as everybody else is there. And from my perspective, I have a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old. And the attorneys that I work with, it's my goal to show them that I can be successful in the office and also get home for dinner. So I think I think that it's so important to be able to show them that instead of showing them my FaceTime at, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock at night.
Yeah. I think that it really is this idea of what's an expected work day. Does it have to be the same hours for everyone? Could we put it on one side or the other? Because there is something to be said for a few cores out of the day where you all see each other. Because I do think that we have different kinds of conversations in person, but I don't think everybody has to be there the exact same amount of hours every day if people's life circumstances are different for what that looks like. And I guess I know depending on how junior you are in your career, it's harder to ask, but if you know that even if you get a no, your relationship with your boss hasn't changed, why not ask? I think most of us don't ask because of Western norms of work. And if we could get ourselves out of that a little bit, we'd be a lot less stressed out as a nation.
So to try to, as best I can, to try to tie this together with a final question, and I do thank you for your time. We're so unaware of the majority of our own body language and what people see, but we so much rely on the body language of others to understand what's going on in the world. How do we become more self-aware of our body language?
I think it really does take practice. And like, even if there were certain, you know, I'm going into a meeting, in this meeting, I'm going to be super mindful of like my body language. I think that body language, you know, like Amy, the research that shows like you can shape yourself into certain things. I think it really is though. Body language is one of the things, we're so much more mindless about it than we are the words that we choose. And so I think that if we ever in our heads were like, okay, how am I going to say this? If we thought, how am I going to present this? It would be, none of us think that way, right? So just to like even practice that in little moments, you know, if we practice it going into several meetings, then, you know, it might help me because I'm one of the people that, you know, I'm making eye contact with people and then I look down at my phone. Well, can I resist my phone for 1 hour? I should be able to, right? And so I think it's this idea of building in that mindfulness for something that nobody's ever told us we need to be mindful about.
Well, thank you. I told Professor Guerin this when she was on the podcast, and I'll tell you, but Creighton gave me so much at my time there, and it was such a gift that they gave me. And all I want to do is share that gift. So having you on this podcast, it has just been an absolute joy. I'm so thankful. I'm so grateful that you decided to join us. Thank you so much.
You are so welcome. And I hope that my foray into just exploring a little about the courtroom is helpful for someone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ralph Waldo Emerson said, "What you do speaks so loudly that I cannot hear what you say." I'm thinking this holiday season through the lens of nonverbal communication, and specifically how we can act with compassion and kindness. People say we should perform random acts of kindness, nonverbals, acts. The understanding nod, the reassuring eyes, the warm handshake, smile, hold the door open, high five someone, treat someone to coffee, be a good listener. Open your heart using your whole body without words. Let us not point the finger or cross our arms. Let us put kindness into action by performing acts of kindness. Thank you for listening. This was A Conflict of Interest.